Of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke are referred to as the synoptics, as you know, because the stories they tell often overlap. What you find in one Gospel is often repeated in another, albeit with subtle differences. For example, although Mark's the shortest of those three Gospels, in fact, he's the shortest of the four, although Mark is the shortest, it's Mark who paints in the detail which others leave out, such as in the feeding of the 5,000. It's Mark who tells us that it happens in spring because the people sat down on much green grass. Similarly, in the miracle of the healing of the woman who was bleeding, Mark and Matthew both tell us that she had spent a considerable amount of money over the years on doctor's bills trying to get the condition sorted out. Luke, who himself was a doctor, understandably omits that comment on the medical profession. The Gospel of John, in contrast to the other three, is quite different. It's quite different in style and approach. Instead of being set in Galilee, a lot of John's Gospel is set in Jerusalem. Instead of parables, there are some long passages of teaching that Jesus shares with his disciples. And miracles in John's Gospel are usually referred to as signs. In the three synoptic Gospels, Jesus often sits down to teach. In John, he stands. The other thing that comes only in John are the I am sayings. I am the bread of life. I am the good shepherd. And today's I am the light of the world. The other thing which I think is important in understanding a Gospel passage, it's true of all of the Gospels, but I think particularly so of John's Gospel, is to set the passage into its context. Now, if you're familiar with the layout of John's Gospel, you'll know that the first 11 verses, we started reading at John chapter 8, verse 12. The first 11 verses of John chapter 8 are a puzzle. They're a puzzle, and because your Bible will have a footnote at the bottom that says something like, the earliest manuscripts and many other ancient witnesses do not have this passage up to John 11. Indeed, nowadays, a lot of Bibles print the passages in italics or smaller print. It's a fascinating passage, and I'm sure it's scriptural. But I also think it's in the wrong place. It shouldn't be there in John 8. It spoils the flow in some ways. And therefore, when we pick up today's reading, which started, as Adrian read it, when Jesus spoke again, when we have to put it into context, we've got to go back not just to the bit immediately before, but to chapter 7 to see where Jesus was and what he'd been doing. Now, in chapter 7, Jesus is in Jerusalem, and he's in Jerusalem for the Festival of the Tabernacles. It was an annual Jewish festival that took place in early autumn. It was their equivalent of our harvest festival. It was a chance to thank God for his goodness to the people in the recent harvest, and also to look back to the time when God had led the children of Israel through the desert as they journeyed to the promised land. And as part, Jesus is in the temple. Now, you might wonder why Jesus spoke up in the temple courts when he knew that the Pharisees and the others would be there to criticize him and to challenge what he was saying. Why didn't he opt for a word in the back streets of the town or the quiet byways? Thinking about it, Jesus spoke in the temple courts, first, because that's where the people were. Second, because for the moment, as it says in verse 20 at the end of the reading, his time had not yet come, and therefore he was able to speak out in the temple courts. And third, and I think this is the one we least appreciate, Jesus spoke in the temple courts because of all the symbolism that was going on around about him. The symbolism of the temple itself and of all the various ceremonies that took place within the temple. Now, the Festival of the Tabernacles, their harvest festival, is the background to what Jesus is doing and saying in these chapters. And therefore, to put Jesus' words into context, we need to know something of the background of the festival. And with the Festival of the Tabernacles, it's reminding them of the time when Israel left Egypt, traveled out, led by God, with this pillar of cloud in the day and this pillar of fire at night. One of the symbols of the festival was therefore light. The Jews were remembering their days in the wilderness. And as a reminder of that pillar of fire, a lamp was lit every evening in part of the temple complex. It was lit in what was known as the Court of Women. And it wasn't just a little lamp, it was huge. It was said that the light from the lamp could be seen all over Jerusalem. So I imagine it wasn't just lit, but it was hoisted up quite high. A bit like a lighthouse idea, I suppose. One contemporary writer says there was no courtyard of the city which couldn't see the light from the temple. So this is the brightest light that they could have produced. Now, John, in his writing of his gospel, doesn't specifically tell us that it was the court of women. Perhaps he was sensitive that some of the readers weren't associated with the layout of the Jerusalem temple, and therefore he didn't want to introduce the thought into their minds about, you know, what was Jesus doing in this court of women. But he does tell us that Jesus was teaching, again, this comes from the end of the reading, he does tell us that Jesus was teaching in the temple area near the place where the offerings were put. And that would tie in with this particular location. So Jesus was there in the temple of women with his lamp. The other thing that John doesn't tell us, this is a particular pity, because naturally, in reading this story, we think it's daytime. You know, we think it's 11 o'clock in the morning, like it is now. Supposing it was evening. Supposing it was evening at the time when the lamp was being lit and hoisted up. I wonder if it wasn't the evening. And when that lamp is being lit and the people have gathered for that ceremony, it's then that Jesus declares, "I am the light of the world." Now think about it. There's Jesus in the temple, stood next to a lamp that is symbolizing something from the past, a time when God visibly led the Jewish nation by providing them with a light that was there for the Jews. And this lamp, the brightest thing that they could produce, reminded them of the brightest thing that they had ever been, the pillar of fire that had led the Jewish Exodus. And stood next to it is Jesus, promising that he would be a light, not just to the Jews, but to the whole world. It's a startling thing to say and a significant place to say it in. Now we, with all our lights in the world, hardly ever appreciate what physical darkness is. I think the only times I've experienced it in recent years are when we've been away and staying in a cottage in the country, where at nights there are no street lights and no other places nearby. Then it can be really, really dark. I've also been down a coal mine when I was teaching donkeys years ago on school trips, and they've turned off all the lights. And believe me, those few seconds of darkness were, oh, awful. I was fortunate to be in the Southwest, when would it be, 1999, 24 years ago, when we had the eclipse of the sun. I didn't see a total eclipse, that was in Cornwall. We were in Dorset, but it got pretty near. It got dark very quickly, dark enough for the street lights in the village behind us to come on, and cold enough to make us shiver. It would have been a nice day, nice sunny day, and we'd gone out to sit on this cliff top in probably our shirt sleeves, and it suddenly became very, very cold. But the thing I remember most clearly about the day was the cheer that went up when the sun reappeared from behind the moon. You see, we don't like darkness. Humans aren't nocturnal creatures. We need the light. Physical light is good. Jesus, of course, was talking not about physical light, but about spiritual light. Yet I want to say that just as we're programmed to dislike physical darkness, so we aren't comfortable with the spiritual dark. But with Jesus alongside, we need never be in that spiritual dark, for Jesus' promise is that those who follow him will never walk in darkness, but will always have the light of life. Now, as Jesus said these words, it was inevitable that there were some in the temple courts, the Pharisees, they were on hand to hear him and to mock what he was saying. They heard him, and yet they didn't hear him. They knew Jesus was speaking, and from experience, they knew his words were likely to be controversial. But they didn't actually hear what he was saying. They didn't challenge him on his words. They didn't ask the obvious question, how on earth could you, a human, be a light? But instead, they challenged him because he was claiming things without calling a witness. What Jesus said was staggering and momentous. Jesus was saying that he, not the lamp alongside him, he was the light of the world. And of course, his use of the expression, I am, underlines the link he was making with God. For I am is that special phrase that God used when giving his credentials to Moses at the burning bush. When Moses asked God for his name, God replied something along the lines of, I am who I am. I am is the name of the Lord. When we hear the phrase, I am the light of the world, we understand the enormity of Jesus' claims, and so did some of the people who heard him, for a little bit later on at verse 30, it tells us that as he spoke, many put their faith in him. But not so the Pharisees. They challenged Jesus, not on his words, but on his boldness to testify without a witness. Now, Jesus was talking in spiritual terms, but they were so limited to the human realm and judged him by earthly standards. And this is always a warning for us. You know, with things of God, they're not on the same level as the things of earth. They wanted two witnesses. They wanted two witnesses to testify him. That was the law laid down among other places in Deuteronomy 19. And for that purpose, Jesus offered himself as one and his Father as the other. Yet when Jesus spoke about his Father, they didn't ask, who is your Father? But where is your Father? Almost implying that if he was close at hand, they'd go and question him. They're trying to judge the heavenly by earthly standards. And that, as Jesus says, is why they cannot understand him. And notice also that Jesus said to them that he doesn't come to judge. They're judging him, but he said he's not come to judge. Now, we've got to put that little statement, that little sentence, into context, because we know that Jesus is the judge. In fact, it's already been said earlier on in John chapter 5, the Father judges no one, but has entrusted all judgment to the Son. And elsewhere in the Gospels, particularly in Matthew's Gospel, Matthew's got a fair bit to say about judgment. Jesus' judgment is linked to his coming in glory. Jesus is the judge now and will be. But then, at that point in time, when he was alive on earth, his ministry was not one of judgment. And yet there's a sense in which people judge themselves by whether they accepted Jesus or rejected his claims. If they chose to reject him, they're cutting themselves off and judging themselves. But it's not Jesus who's actively at that point doing the judging. Let's return, though, to the phrase, I am the light of the world. We have the I am, the divine name. And Jesus is not shying away from it. He's not shying away from using it, but boldly proclaiming it. And he proclaims now, I am the light. Now, all of us as humans, as I say, respond to light. We prefer it to darkness. But alongside physical light, I also think we need, indeed long for, spiritual light. My experience as a hospital chaplain has shown me over the years, but lots of people are searching, they're looking, they're wondering for something beyond themselves. We know at the start of creation, God the Creator said, "Let there be light." We also know that the world was made through Jesus, for he is the word through which creation was spoken. So when at the creation of the world, as recorded in Genesis, God speaks through Jesus to say, "Let there be light," it's now the same Jesus who in the form of a man declares himself to be the light of the world. And not just a light to see the way, but a light to improve our being. I've said we don't like to be in darkness. In fact, in winter, we often get sad, don't we? Mentally sad, which we now know to be a vitamin D deficiency. Something our body requires, but it comes naturally from the sunlight. I'm sure I'm not alone in this room in taking a vitamin D supplement in the winter. You don't need it in summer because there's enough sunlight around. Isn't it also true that this link to the divine that our minds crave is also accomplished by the light? We need the spiritual light for our well-being. Light can also be a cleanser. You know, we all know, again, that we don't get as ill in the summer as we do in the winter. And it's partly because bugs on surfaces that are exposed to sunlight are destroyed by the cleansing rays of the sun. I believe ultraviolet rays are involved in the purification of water. So perhaps there's also a sense that Jesus is describing himself as a light and as a cleanser. Something to shift wrongness, something to remove evil, wickedness. And oh my goodness, if it was needed then in the days of Jesus, so it's needed in shovelfuls today. And a final thought from this passage is this. A final thought is this, that Jesus said he was the light of the world, not a lamp in the temple, for the benefit of the worshippers there, not even a pillar of fire visible to the Jewish nation, but he said he was a light for the whole world. We live, as I've said, in an increasingly dark age, a world that needs light to show us where to travel, a light to put back the deficiencies that we find in ourselves as individuals, as a society, and a light to cleanse us, and to make us whole. So to conclude, we have Jesus' great statement, "I am the light of the world." It's said against the background of the festival of the tabernacles, where as part of the festival, a lamp was lit to remind Israel of the way in which God had guided the nation in the past. And Jesus takes the image and declares that he's a greater light, a light of a whole world, and one which will always shine in the darkness for those who believe in him. Then the discussion that follows turns upon God as the Father of Jesus. But that's too much for Jesus' opponents, the Pharisees. They can only judge things by earthly standards. And while people then and now remain earthbound, they'll never understand all there is about Jesus. Jesus and the Father can only be understood by an openness to what's above. The authorities lack that openness. They don't see Jesus as the one sent by God. And in so doing, they turn their backs on the light of the world. May we be people to take this statement, to understand what it means, that Jesus is there as our light. And may we radiate, may we reflect that light back out around to all those that we meet. Amen.